What's up, world? I'm your host, Angelica Beener, and this is Milestones, Celebrating the Culture, a podcast where my special guests and I celebrate landmark projects that are celebrating a milestone year. Our latest episode brings you into the world of jazz trumpeter and composer Jeremy Pelt, a modern luminary whose work bridges generations, blending the echoes of the past with the urgency of the now. And in this conversation, Pelt opens up about his powerful new album, Our Community Will Not Be Erased. It's a bold, heartfelt tribute to resilience, love, and the enduring spirit of the Black community, and we'll explore what it means to collaborate across generations as he's done here. And Pelt reflects on working with those revered artists and the deeper dialogue that jazz makes possible. He also shares the personal side of his artistry, including the beautiful emotional tribute to his late sister, the great Danielle Spencer, a moment that captures how music can hold grief, healing, and transcendence all at once. We'll also discuss Wayne Shorter's 1966 album Speak No Evil, which is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, and our discussion brought out the timeless quality inherent in Shorter's melodies and in his arrangements, which serve as both a source of inspiration and a benchmark for musicians striving for the highest musical authenticity. So let's get right into it. I like to call you at this point friend to Milestones.
That's a good way of putting it. I think that's accurate.
Yeah, thanks for always coming back, and it's always really fun getting to chat with you, so thanks for being back.
You know, look, thanks for having me back. You know, a lot of times in the entertainment field, people are like, yeah, no, we're definitely come back and see us, and then, you know, they never do.
Right, exactly.
It's all good. Thank you.
Yeah. Congratulations on your new album, Our Community Will Not Be Erased. Love the title. We're going to get into that in a second. I'm sure that is something you get asked about a lot.
Well, I mean, it hasn't happened quite as much as I thought, but I mean, that's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, you know how it is. But let's get into the title, because I've read a couple of reviews or articles where they frame it as, you know, provocative, you know, to paraphrase. You've been pretty straightforward about the idea that this is not necessarily a protest album, that it's an album rooted more in love and resilience. And I guess what I'd like to know from you before we start talking about the music, which is fantastic, is why that delineation or that clarification is important to you.
I think that it kind of goes against the grain of, you know, what could be and what has been described in the past as the angry Black man or angry Black woman trope, you know what I mean? And I think that especially what's happening today, which you can't, it, no one can possibly turn a blind eye into, it would be expected that anyone, any Black artist is going to come out here with something that's in protest. And to that effect, they would be right within their own right to do so, you know, because it's enough to get everybody angry. So it's not even that I'm trying to be on the other side of that, like, let's not protest, of course. But I think that the angle that I'm coming from is that I wanted to celebrate the things that are important in the Black community, and then especially with Black families. And that's what I sought to do on this. And yeah, I mean, provocative is the narrative, and I'm not mad at it. I've even used it myself, because sometimes I do like to be tongue-in-cheek and be cheeky about things and be like, oh, you know, and to draw people and be like, oh, it's not what I thought. But then you get something else. So yeah, it is provocative, but also, you know, it's declarative. You know, I mean, there's all types of images that we'll look at of people doing direct orders from the president saying, all right, let's erase this. You know, let's take, you know, all these artifacts out of the Black History Museum and act like it didn't exist. Like I said in the liner notes, make it chimerical. Even though you have pictures of people ripping off, you know, posters and things like that. So, I mean, that is in itself them trying to erase not only the history, but also the very existence. And so that's exactly where that's coming from.
understood, and I commend you for it, and I thank you for it. What is your feeling around, well, this question is kind of twofold. I will say this is a very heightened, intense, maybe a concentrated moment in our history where the backlash, if you will, for speaking up and speaking out is heightened. What gives you the courage to do it now? And how do you feel about artists, particularly in our community, who have chosen to stay silent? Does it bother you? Does it piss you off? Do you feel to each his own? And what made you feel like you could do it and you will let the chips fall where they lie if need be?
I feel like every artist is, Black artist, is going to come to terms with the way that they want to deal with it and win. So I always give grace to that because, I mean, like you said, this isn't anything new. And certainly, you know, I've been around for quite a few years. I mean, I've seen the LA riots. I mean, it's kind of sadly a full circle moment when you think about, you know, what you've been told from your elders and your parents about them seeing things in the 60s. And now you're seeing it, you know, but even back then, I mean, we were talking about the LA riots. That was 92, you know, and I was 16, you know, years old. So, I mean, I was more than grown enough to witness what provoked it and how it all happened. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly had my share of incidences, so I've never been blind to it. I've always poked at certain instances, you know, I mean, especially if it really, because, you know, sadly, the thing about it is that we're so desensitized. The community is so desensitized to it, to all the, you know, the just everything in this country, in this world, that it's strange to react to it almost, because it's just like, okay, you know, yet another example. But so certain things get on your skin. Like I remember, I mean, I released a record back in, 2014, whatever, I forgot what year it was, you'll have to forgive me, but Eric Garner was murdered, right? And so I've always had little moments of saying things. Mm-hmm. You know, now, where it's at right now, I think the older you get and also the more advanced you get in your artistry, the mm-hmm. more you say, okay, you know, I'm really sick and tired of this and I want to, you know, write about this, or I want to celebrate certain virtues and come from it from other angles. Mm-hmm. So once you start to realize, or at least in my case, once I started to realize how I wanted to put together a cohesive statement that addresses my concerns, but also does it in a way that is maybe a little bit different than, you know, the next Black artist would do it, then I acted upon it. But I don't ever, you know, look at other Black artists that haven't addressed it, because there'll come a time, or maybe it won't. You know, I mean, it's the same type of thing. It's like, you know, when all that stuff was happening to like Nat King Cole in the South, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And you know, he just was like, or Louis Armstrong, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, we know it's there, even though he's out there talking about Hello Dolly, you know, it has to affect him. And, you know, of course, I'm not comparing myself with stature. I think an artist arrives to what they want to say in the time that they want to do it.
Yeah, you're right. Like the lens through which we look at artists, the way we look at Louis Armstrong, sometimes, you know, it's tricky because this was somebody who put up with a lot so that we wouldn't have to, and or Jackie Robinson. And what that may have looked like is something that we have the benefit of judging in hindsight, but that we probably should maybe take a beat before we go in, right?
And, you know, it just reminds me of another thing that I thought was quite powerful. And I'll mention this even though, you know, he's canceled. But I will say that the legacy of the show is going to be enduring. And I'm talking about The Cosby Show. And, yes. You know, I think about, you know, I remember seeing something, probably was however many, 10 years, 15 years ago, where they had this is before he was canceled, when they had a whole celebration of the legacy. And they were talking to Felicia Rashad about it. And she mentioned, you know, about the impact of it, but, you know, them not having to actually say anything or enact anything about it. It this was just a show of black, about a great family that was tight-knit. Both parents just happened to have be gainfully employed in great careers, and they were black. And you know what? They had white people come over all the time. They had people all, you know, and they entertained, and they just did the things that we've all grown up seeing white family shows do all the time. Growing Pains and all these family ties and whatnot. So why can't we do it? And they said, and we did it, and but we just didn't raise no flag and be like, yeah, see, and you know, it was just, right. Just celebrating what it is. And
yeah,
I think that I always dug that approach. Not that this that was in the back of my mind when I created this record, but it's just something that popped in my mind right now that sometimes doesn't need to have, you know, a flag planted in it to dig where I'm coming from.
Indeed, exactly. Yeah, I want to talk about the personnel on this album. You have, it's an intergenerational all-star band with some legendary heavy hitters. You have Orrin Evans on piano, Buster Williams on bass, Lenny White on drums, and Lasse Korsen on keyboards and electronic textures and feels and things. So, I mean, this is quite a band when you think about just the scope, the breadth of who these players have been as frontmen, sidemen, the history that you all encompass is enough to fill a stadium. So tell me about maybe, but you've always worked with in an intergenerational capacity. I think it's one of the things that makes you very important to this music outside of your artistry. It's sort of the intentionality around that. Roy Hargrove did that as well. I wonder if you could talk to me about the importance of collaborating in an intergenerational way and why it was important on this album in particular.
I think connection and connectivity is always an important thing in terms of continuing the fiber of the music. And you and I have talked especially about my Griot project, and it addresses just that. It's really having them, and when I say them, I'm talking about the older musicians that we revere so much, bless the project. And me as a younger musician, still, not that they need me to prove their vitality and their artistry to a younger group, but it's the same thing, the feeling that I got with Roy. You know what I mean? Roy would, like you said, you know, Roy would have Larry Willis and Ronnie Matthews and all these cats. And it was like, you know, I think, didn't he have like Billy Higgins on his first record? You know, I mean, and it's just like, why wouldn't you? That's the thing. Like if you have, you know, here's the thing. Not everybody is going to be able to be blessed enough to play with a Ron Carter or Lenny White, Buster Williams. I mean, those cats are highly selective about who they play with, and they've earned the right to be, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have that kind of, and I call it a blessing for them to be in favor with them, then it's like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and, you know, punch this ticket and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And with in Buster's case, I've done that a few times now. You know, these are all people that I'd played with through the course of almost 30 years and being in New York. And when you ask why now, a lot of times what I have going into the new year, because as you notice, I release a record every year, is I start to have ideas about what I want to, who I want to record with. Like I've got an idea for next year, right? I'm not gonna say what, but I generally think on those terms. For instance, the CD that I put out two CDs ago, The Art of Intimacy, Volume 2, had Buster and Billy Hart. Now, I'm thinking, and I remember the moment that I thought about it, because it's a ballad CD, right? And I was like, who should I get on bass drums? And I've got a pretty expansive record collection. So I'm listening to Shirley Horn. I'm listening to all these people, but I'm listening to Shirley Horn record. And I pull out this record that she did on Steeplechase, I think it's September Afternoon, but it has Buster and Billy on it. You know what? They're still around and in the best shape of their life. So why not have them, you know, why not experience that? Because I always was a big Shirley Horn that I used to go see her all the time. So now to be able to do that, I'm like, man, that's heavy. And so with this, it's the same type of thing. So now I wanted Buster because I love that beat that he has. Mm-hmm. And Lenny and I played together in many different configurations over the years. And I was like, yeah, I need to document this. So it's also in the spirit of documentation. It's like, you know, I want to document for myself. And I call these records snapshots because even though we're going to do a couple gigs this year, there's no thing in me that says, yeah, this is my band and I'm taking this out for years and years. No, they got things that they want to do and they're going to do with their own thing. So I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do is document this right here. You know, and it's the same thing I did when I had Ron Carter on the record. If he don't ever use me on anything, I got this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's what it was. And as far as Oren is concerned, I've always wanted to record with Oren. I was just looking for the right opportunity. And this was it. And this, you know, and I started to put together the music really maybe this time last year. And, you know, finished it round about, you know, in August.
Mm-hmm.
And was just very excited because I could hear each one of them. There was very few words that I had to say to them in preparation, rehearsing, because they already had it. And that's a beautiful thing when you write for musicians that you know are going to be able to produce what it is that you're hearing in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, you know, I mean, a lot of times, there's two types of recording artists, right? There's the type, leaders rather. There's a type that'll record something, and as soon as they record it, they want to get as far away from it as possible for a couple weeks just to clear their head, which I also get. But I'm the other type that's like, as soon as I record it, I'm like listening to it all the time, choosing takes. Like, the takes are already chosen, like within a day. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And I'm listening to it, and I'm just like, damn. And it's like you're pinching yourself. On a lot of these songs, I'm like, man, this is just like, because cats don't, I mean, you don't get that. That's the other thing, is that especially with Buster and Lenny, you're not going to get that. This is the kind of sound that young cats my age, and especially younger, have been trying to replicate for years. Real deal right here. So you're not going to get that from cats my age. Don't get me wrong. I love cats my age, and there's great things that are being done right now. That's wonderful. But when we talk about swinging and that quarter note, and you're not going to get that ever. Once they, you know, and I don't mean to be, you know, sad about it or anything, but once that thing leaves, it's gone. When Roy Haynes left, that's gone. You see what I mean? When Elvin left, that's gone. And those of us that got a chance to play with him or hear him, we could feel blessed that we got a chance to hear, because as many cats cop the stuff and know how to do it, that stuff is great. And you want an Elvin type of thing, and they go ahead and do it. It ain't that,
right?
You know, I mean, you can say the same thing about, you know, once Hub was gone, it's gone. I've done my best to copy. Doesn't matter. It's not that, and that's what I'm saying. You know, with Buster and Lenny, that's the real deal right there, and you want the real deal.
Mm.
I just think that if you're not in the space that have been blessed by it, then it makes it harder to have an argument towards it. You know
what I mean? I see.
So it's almost like saying that, you know, I guess, you know what I mean? I'm just going to focus on me and, you know, the fact that I've been blessed enough to feel that. And not only from them, but from, you know, Lewis Hayes and all. You listen, man, I just got off, you know, I teach over at William Patterson, and I've got some very talented players, trumpet players, students of mine, and I love them all dearly. They're younger, of course. And I also see, you know, young students all the time, young trumpet and cats. You know, the thing that irks me the most is that cats don't know how to phrase or play anything that's at a true medium tempo. You know, it's like, the thing is, everybody's going to play things that are fast because you could mask things easier that way. You
can
playing and waving your fingers, but when it comes down to, and you got to sync and you're trying to just play some swing and some eighth notes, and you playing with your peers who don't know how to do that, then it's just going, the whole thing is just going to implode. So these cats, the Ron Carters, the Buster Williams, all the cats that are still that we have with us, the Louis Hayes's,
George Colemans.
Colemans are here to hold us accountable. And those of us that are smart enough to be around that will benefit from that. And not only be around it, but to humble yourselves to know that you're trying to get to that.
Yes.
I mean, I've been playing with Louis Hayes for 26 years. And that's Mr. Quarter Note.
Right.
You know, if he didn't like my playing, I'd have been going, you know, we wouldn't have this conversation.
Right.
But I've always learned from that, you know, which got me prepared to be able to play with the Jimmy Heaths and the Cedar Walls and everybody else, because I've absorbed that lesson. And, you know, going back to the younger students, that's something that, and just younger cats just in general, when we talk about just the use of the quarter note and the phrasing aspect, when you have these cats like, you know, Buster Williams and Lenny, you really just want to feel that. That's the reason why they're on the record, is because I want to feel all that experience. When I had Buster on the Ballads record, I want to feel why Sarah Vaughan, Nancy Wilson, Dinah Washington, everybody called him. He had so many gigs. Miles asked him to join the band. He was like, I can't leave Nancy. I had time to play with Herbie after a while. But that is what I was banking on. Billy Hart, you know, still playing all this music and was playing with Shirley Horn and everybody. That's what I was trying to get. And that's the same thing here. It's like, I want to know, feel what Freddie was feeling, you know, on Red Clay, you know, or feel what Dizzy Reese and Woody Soul were feeling on Passing Ships with Andrew Hill. I mean, so it's a, man, listen, that's gold right there as far as I'm concerned.
Amen. Amen. Talk about it. Thank you for that. That's really, I hope people are really going to listen with intent, you know, to what you just said, because I think it's very important.
Yeah, that quarter note, by all means necessary. I'm serious about that. This
it's
something to be treasured. I'll never, you know, forget when Roy told me, you know, we were at a session in Wales years ago, you know, we were going, he said, man, I like your quarter notes. And that's a smart thing.
Yeah.
It's not as, it's something to really cherish. How that was in that endeared you to the culture of the music. You see what I mean? Warren Smith said in one of the interviews, he said, you know, when people said you couldn't swing, that meant that you weren't connected to the culture of the music. You see what I mean? So despite everything that's going on and all the permutations that have gone on in this music, the groove is always essential. And that's what I'm talking about when I say the quarter note. It's always essential. If we even talk about Earth, Wind, and Fire, we talk about Ohio players. We don't even have to talk about swinging in the literal sense, but the groove, that one, is essential.
Come on now.
Yeah, we go from there to Maxwell. And if you're talking about doom, ba-doom, doom, doo-da-loom, doom, doo-doom, people respond to the groove. That's the black music right there.
That's right. That's right. There it is. There it is. You talked about this album being rooted in love, grounded in love, and it's evident from the opening tune. I want to offer once again my deepest, most heartfelt condolences with the loss of your sister on this earthly plane anyway, Danielle Spencer. And we unfortunately are in a club nobody wants to be in with the loss of a big sis. And so I can only imagine, you know, the specificity of what you're going through, especially as she was someone who is so important to Black culture. And I wanted to ask you about the song that you dedicated to your sister, which is so beautiful. I remember writing an essay for my sister when she passed, and it was a daunting task, I'll put it that way. What was your experience? Was it something that was cathartic? Was it something that, take me, if you don't mind, and you can touch on this as much or as little as you want. Talk me through the journey of that tune, if you want to.
I was in my makeshift studio at home composing. And a lot of times, my hands, and you know, this is not, you know, any kind of flex or me trying to seem like I'm some kind of genius, but a lot of times my
hands, go ahead.
my hands will just land on the piano, and it'll be like on a chord, and then it's okay. That's interesting, and I still have the tape that I made of myself playing it on my keyboard. It certainly wasn't meant to be any longer than it was. And I think that it really captured her body, her spirit rather, leaving this earth for better planes, you know, especially the last three chords ascending. So the whole thing was more about an ascension. It's like when you let a balloon go and pretty soon you're not going to see it anymore. And that's the kind of feeling that it was. You know, around that same time, I was also tasked with, sadly, I've eulogized just about everybody that I've lost in my family, from my grandfather, my grandmother, to my sister. So, I've had to write a eulogy for her funeral too. So, I mean, I think it was all around the same time, because that really happened all around then, you know. Mm-hmm. Up writing music for that. It was a strange creative period, to say the least, because she died, but then I also was writing music for a Christmas album. I was supposed to record the album on that day, you know, or a couple days after, and I was like, no, I can't, you know. But you know, I'm doing arrangements of Let It Snow and shit, and I'm, you know, I'm like, it, you know. So it was, you know. But I think the best way to really categorize the song is in really more of an ascendance into heaven.
Yeah. Those last three chords, the first time I heard them, I literally felt chills. So now to know that there was some, obviously everything has purpose, but now to know that there was something much deeper about that, I can tell you as a listener, it really resonates. It's just, you know. And then the warmth in your touch in those moments too, just, you know, it feels, you can feel that love that you have for your sister. Yeah. Yeah. There's fathers and sons and our mother's nature and brothers on the corner. I mean, this feels like a love letter to Black people. Can you walk me through a little bit of the, you know, some of the concepts around the titles and the music also?
You know, with fathers and sons, it, you know, you try, you, what you're doing is raising a man. And what that song was to me was more of a conversation about strength and resilience. And so that's what I tried to embody within that, in that that musical atmosphere. And then of course we have March Into Resilience, which, you know, I think it took me the longest time to title that one. And then I really started to listen to it and I was like, man, this is this kind of straightforward, like we're not gonna take it no more. You know, no matter how much we get knocked down, we're still going forward. That song was, especially even in its performance. You see what I mean? The head still kept recurring. There was, we were in and out of some improvisations, but it still kept going, and it had mounted.
Yes.
The visual that I had with that. Brothers on the Corner, I live on the corner, a very active quarter. And if anybody that lives in the neighborhood with black folks know, especially on Amsterdam Avenue in Harlem, at any given hour of night. Not to say, it's never been violent in the whole time that I've been there, but you're gonna have some brothers on the corner in front of the bodega talking a lot of smack and loud.
Yeah.
So that's really what it is. It's just like, you know, whatever. You just go hear that. And I'm like right on the corner. You know, I'm like on the third floor, just hearing this all the time. You know, I've learned to sleep through it a lot of times, but that's essentially what that meant. And, you know, it's funny because I think maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago, Buster was doing a guest emceeing at WKCR, guest DJing rather, and he chose that song to play. And so the programmer sent it to me like, yeah, I thought you would know that, wanted to know that Buster chose this song. And the way that he described it, because he understood, of course he understood it. You know, his brother, he's like, back in my day, you know, brothers on the corner, we're singing doo-wop.
That's right.
You know, I mean, so there's been this tradition.
Of brothers on the corner.
Where we congregate, you know.
And you know what I love about it? I love that a song like Brothers on the Corner is a love letter to the brothers versus, like, it's so amazing how, depending on the lens, how something can look, right? Like, we see every 5 seconds, you know, a video of someone who's not minding their business and drinking their water, coming up to people, you know, you shouldn't be here. You know, you shouldn't do that. You know, you're this, you know, you're that, and sort of policing people that look, who look like us, just simply congregating, right? But we see it through a lens of, and that's not to say that, it, you know, we never, you know, it's like you said, sometimes you just want to get some sleep, you know, sometimes, you know, it's, but the bottom line is that we are a colorful, expressive people.
Yeah.
And that is part of the fabric of who we are when we congregate, wherever we congregate. We're going to laugh loud, you know, we run when we laugh loud, you know, we hit slap each other, you know, this is who we are. So when I hear this song, it feels like that counter to, you know, why are you standing here, and you know you shouldn't be here, and you know I'm gonna call the cops if blah 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 blah. But if we can see the humanity in that, you know, yeah, then you get beautiful poetry like this.
That's exactly how I thought about it. Fathers and Daughters is an open letter conversation. It was just something that it came off remarkably well. It was just like, I listened to that a lot, and I'm very pleased with how it came out, because it's just a conversation. It's like, you know, I've got two daughters, and the conversations range from, you know, silly, slightly serious, you know, more serious for their age, and you know it'll get more and more heavy the older they get. I mean, my oldest is 15, will be 15 this year, and her sister will be 10. So, I mean, but it, really for me, it's about the connection between the father and the daughter, especially, and that's fostered, and that's really what I wanted to capture with that, the tenderness of it. Which is also why there's no drums on it in particular. Mm. So it's just openness. You know, what I hear more than anything when I listen to it is air.
Yeah. You know,
The same way that I hear air on Kind of Blue. So, I mean, it's that's where I was coming from. It it's just air and space, and really just ideas that are not overwrought, that are not overplayed, but that just are that flow in a more conversational type of way.
Yeah, but I did want to get to your choice to add these sort of other layers in the music with Lasse's keyboards and, you know, his sounds. Were you hearing that before you recorded? Did you know that's an element you wanted to be sort of a through line? Or like, can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I like that word, through line, because that's really what it was, something that was not meant to be obtrusive, but to really kind of lead into certain aspects of a song or out of certain aspects of a song. And Lasse is quite a talented young man. He just graduated Wayne Patterson this last year, and he was in a few of my ensembles. And he plays drums as well, but I think piano is his main axe. And, you know, I'd follow him on Instagram and, you know, I'd see some of the things that he was doing, you know, with the electronics and whatnot. I was like, okay, I could use that.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that I could hear that could connect into the music in a very musical way, rather than just it being there just because I want keyboards on it. And so that's why I decided to have him in there. And when I started to, because when I compose the music, the answer is no, I didn't hear electronics on it at first. But that's okay too, because it's not, you know, sometimes you compose something and then during the production or even post-composing, then you start to think about ways that you could add to it. I mean, no film that we ever see is completely the way the director thought it was going to be from day one.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
There are other things, and things, a lot of things, frankly, done in post-production are what, oh, well, wait, now we can get this perspective up here by doing it, and we cut this together. And, you know, that's how you make a more perfect, better film.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that was my thought process for it as well, is it's like, okay, I want to see how this could lead into that.
Mm-hmm.
And seamlessly so. So like at the end of Our Mother's Nature, having that kind of that line, you know, kind of resonate after the track is long gone, and then go right down into Fathers and Daughters, I thought was a nice touch.
Oh yeah, beautiful. Everybody, the name of the album is Our Community Will Not Be Erased on the High Note label. And just job well done on that. Everybody go out and support it. I'm playing it every chance I get. It's a very important record, especially at this time in our country where love and rootedness and resilience are things we can really lean into. You go, I wanted to also talk about, we were talking about milestones, and you're on tour right now celebrating the centennial of both John Coltrane and Miles Davis. This is the year of the centennial. There are so many. I don't know what was in the water in 1926, but here we are. So I thought, you know, I'd throw in a little milestone as well. It's the 60th anniversary of Wayne Shorter's Speak No Evil this year. It came out in 1966. It is a beloved record for both of us. And I just wondered if you had any reflections on the album's importance or favorite tracks or anything like that?
It's almost an unfair question because I feel like most of you, Wayne Shorter's records are paramount. Mm-hmm. I think that that CD, I could only just remember the first time I heard it. I was in high school and I was listening to Chuck Niles on KLON in Los Angeles. Mm. And they played, you know, and they played it. And I just, the melody, first of all, was so catchy. Mm-hmm. Now, as a trumpet player, the thing about that CD was that it taught me how to really come in, you know, with a powerful statement of a solo. And Freddie, it was, you would almost thought it was Freddie's record because it was just like every entrance was just like so iconic. And mm-hmm. Freddie almost like, he was a master of doing that at that point in his career, where it was just, all that. And so I remember just being like amazed at the, just the feeling of that whole CD. And didn't they record that on Christmas Day? Or it was either or Christmas Eve.
That I don't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
I could be wrong, but I remember that it was, I think it was that record that was either on Christmas Eve. It definitely was on Christmas Day, but I think it was on December 24th.
Wow.
But, to me, it was just like, there was something special about the way that the rhythm section came together with Ron and Elvin, especially because they had already done a few records before, I think around that same time, like Encounters with Pepper Adams and Tommy Flanagan and Zoot Sims. But that record, man, it was just like something about it. Everything that everybody played was iconic.
Yes.
It was just like,
you said vibe. And yeah, I love Night Dreamer and I love The Soothsayer and all of these albums in almost equal measure. But why do you think that probably of all of Wayne's Blue Note output, Speak No Evil, Night Dreamer, Adam's Apple, you know, these albums that he did sort of in this 4 or 5 year period, what do you think it is about Speak No Evil that kind of sets it apart? Or does it set it apart? Is it set apart for you?
I think there are certain records that have that same cohesiveness. So when you say something like Soothsayer, that definitely has that same cohesiveness. And even though it's much more, I don't want to say experimental, but it could be more avant-garde, considered more avant-garde, like the All-Seeing Eye has something that bounds it together from song to song. But I think that with Speak No Evil, it really skirted the line between, you know, many different avenues of how to play on it. It was still, for lack of a better word, terminology, and I hope you can dig in what I say, it was still very accessible, commercially accessible, and not commercial in the type of boogaloo way, but just in terms of like, you know, like All Seeing Eye didn't really resonate with everybody.
Right.
I mean, you weren't going to play that at the cookout, but
no.
But there was something that was still very catchy about all those themes. And mm-hmm. Even when we talk, okay, so look, if we talk about Soothsayer, Wayne's melodies have, for the most part, always been very singable and always been very memorable. But for the non-musician, let's say, for you to be able to say do-dee-dee-do-do-dee-dee-do-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, that's almost like child's play.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And boo-dee-doo-dee-boo-dee-da-dee-da-doo-dee-da-dee-da-doo-dee, you know, or dee-doo-doo-dee-da-da. All these were very singable melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always pissed that Freddie didn't get a chance to solo on that one. But it was what it was. I mean, just the way that him
ooh, and that would have been
yeah. But just the way that he and Wayne phrased those melodies had a vibe. And that's, you know, I've also made posts about that, just in terms of this, how to be present on those melodies. Because, I mean, they were as good a front line as any, you know. And, of course, that shows from, you know, I think Freddie at that point had left Art Blakey's band. But still, they still had that togetherness right there. And I think that the thing that makes it more of a standout is really the just the melodies. All of them were very strong, very characteristic of what Wayne has been known to do, but all of them with like I said, what, 5 songs on record, all of them were very strong.
Yes, particularly strong.
You know,
Infant Eyes, it's such a gorgeous ballad. And like you said, memorable, singable. I was listening recently to Gene Karn's version of Infant Eyes, and it's, you can see why that song is just a singer's dream by the time she finishes with it. I mean, it's just stunning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, this is what I strive for. You know, because there's only a certain amount of composers that have reached that level of identity within their songs. And, you know, I think that he's right up there with Duke Ellington.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just in terms of just that kind of identity to what they're writing, you already, even if you've never heard it, be like, well, it sounds kind of like a Wayne song. In the same way that you would say, well, yeah, it sounds Duke Ellington-ish. And, you know, of course, you also have to add in Thelonious Monk.
100%. 100%.
This sounds monkish. You know, there's only like, you know, what's the mountain, you know.
The Mount Rushmore, right.
You cast that on the Mount Rushmore for melodies where you could actually change their name into something like Is, Duke-ish, Wayne-ish, monkish.
Facts. Totally. Yes. And it's funny you bring them up, because I think those are like, that's like the Holy Trinity right there for me in terms of composers of that echelon.
That's one of my favorites, so for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Freddie Hubbard, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, Elvin Jones, the great Wayne Shorter. So I also wanted to ask you, when it comes to this album, so this is 1966. Help me frame how this fits in with the second great Miles Davis quintet. And because a lot of time with these great albums, there's like this overlap, like with Train and Giant Steps and Being with Miles, or just sort of just leaving Miles-ish, or about to, you know, left, came back, you know, however that went. And a similar thing is happening with Wayne. First, he was with Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. And how important do you think that sort of incubator was? Because Wayne was contributing a lot of music to the Messengers, and this sort of time where he's his own solo frontman artist, but also with this group. Like, how does that all come out in the wash for you?
So, you know, I think that the most significant stuff that Wayne had done with Miles at that point was ESP, because that was 65, right? And so now you have this record that he's now getting to know, or has gotten to know Wayne and Ron in that context for some time. And Freddie always had a rapport with all of them, with Ron, Elvin. And so it just all made sense. You know, I wish that was a question that I would have asked Wayne, because sometimes I wonder how they arrived at some of the choices. For instance, on Etc., you know, I was always wondering how Cecil McBee came to be on that date, you know, and Joe Chambers,
mm-hmm.
when it seemed like the obvious choice would have been, you know, Ron and Tony. But Cecil McBee set me straight because I was able to talk to Cecil, and he said, well, listen, I was in Wayne's working band back then, and Wayne's working band was actually me, Roy Haynes, and Albert Daly. Realistically, Herbie and Joe were the subs. You know?
Come on now.
I was like, okay, well, there you have it.
Right.
It's always something that I've wondered. I really can't speak intelligently about how, you know, what went into the choices. I do know that at a certain point, you know, Miles had his kind of loose kind of recording ban on Tony, where he paid Tony for a year not to record with anybody. Mm-hmm. Or if that still fell under that. But there's also enough of a difference that kind of have to attribute to Wayne knowing the touch that he wanted on his music to where it made all the sense in the world to have Elvin on there instead of somebody that he's already working with night to night because of that thing that Elvin brings. Because, I mean, you know, sometimes you play these games like, you know, like, wonder how this would have sounded if Tony were on it. And, you know, Tony, of course, is killing, but it wouldn't have sounded the same.
Right.
It wouldn't have sounded the same in the same way that the soothsayer would have sounded the same if Elvin was on it. So
right.
You know, the credit is all due to Wayne saying, okay, no, I need some more, you know, kind of grounding on this, mm-hmm. which is what Elvin had that he gets a lot of credit for, is to be able to just hold everybody to what they're doing. You know what I mean? Kept everybody honest. You know?
Yes.
And set things up, because I think the thing about Elvin that a lot of people sleep on is the fact that, you know, at a certain point he never lost touch with wanting to be a big band drummer.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So certain ways that he set up things are what makes that record pop. So when you listen to Witch Hunt and you listen to that break,
woo!
You know what I mean? Nobody else in the world could have done that. Nobody. you know what I mean? And even just the way that he, you know, do 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 damn do damn but do 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 do, you know what I mean? That's why he's on there.
The right man.
You know, and you know, that's what I think about when I think about that record and the mixture of musicians that are on there. Because I mean, he was a generation older than everybody. You know what I mean?
Wow. Yeah.
So that, you know, it all makes sense. It all
absolutely.
Makes, and it's also great to see how they react to his playing after, because, you know, you never know what happened. You know, they might have had a gig with Miles a week before the date. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So for them to come in the studio or at the rehearsal, because they always rehearsed before they went into the studio, and really figure out how to react to what Elvin is doing, it is great, and it came off very well.
Yeah, it really did. So I can't pressure you to tell me your favorite, huh? That's not gonna happen.
I mean, it's not even a thing of me trying to be coy. It's just that it's like, it's hard.
It is. It's unfair, unrealistic, almost silly question. But I just, it's just fun to pit people.
I mean, listen.
Favorite for the day. How about that? Favorite today.
Fee-fi-fo-fo. You know what I mean?
Okay. We go in fee-fi-fo-fo.
My tempo, that tempo is very specific.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It is very hard, especially in today's times, to really capture and to be focused on it and to just groove on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love it so much, because they, I mean, it's just dee do do dee dee dee.
And Herbie playing all those bluesy lines.
Listen, man, I played with Bobby Blue Bland. You know, I played with these blues bands back in the day, and that's all you had to do was just groove on that tempo.
Uh-huh.
Well, you had to know how to do that. If you're coming out, I mean, you got to understand that they're playing this also in the same time that James Brown is grooving.
Live at the Apollo and all, you know, okay, that record came out a couple years later, but they're still grooving on, you know, they're funking on that groove, whatever it is, whether it's swing or whether it's James Brown that's still just, you know, whatever it is, it's still the groove right there. And for them to go ahead and capture that and just stay right there and make it fun, is that's what I love here.
Yeah, thanks for making me think of it that way. Because as you're saying it, I'm like feeling all of what you're saying, you know, as the tape is running in the back of my head. Yeah. Well, yeah, this is such a great album. It's a landmark album for any person who's interested in jazz, and certainly just such a one of the great albums in the Wayne Shorter canon. So thank you for talking to me about that record, man. That's
great. It's great to recall that and remember all that.
Yeah. You know, I think it's one thing that I think in doing these interviews is that the thing that I notice with musicians is that but you wouldn't fall into this category, because you have even on social media talked about the importance of listening to music and the importance of, I mean, you've got a stellar record collection. You are, you know, a true, you know, vinyl collector. And it's Record Store Day on this month as well. So we'll have to swap some records soon. But but you are one of those musicians who I think is still in love with music, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Why not? I mean, that's what it's there for. You know, you kind of have to look at somebody strange and side-eyed that chooses not to listen just to try for reasons of hipness.
That part.
Like, because you could still be highly creative and doing your own thing and still want to listen to something that makes you feel good. And that's what the whole thing is. I think that there's a lot of pressure that comes from critics when other people read what they're writing and say, oh, like, I just read a review of my record the other day in Downbeat. One of them said, well, there's an air of been there, done that. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, at the end of the day, I want to just produce things that feel good.
Amen.
And my listening just kind of deepens with that in mind. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'm unapologetic about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that once, as an artist, you have time to let things soak in and without any kind of deviations or distractions, then you get the true meaning of what it is that you listen. You get what I would call the nutrients of what is being played, rather than if you're running around and you texting and you doing this and doing that and then music's in the background. You see what I mean? So, I mean, I'm all for it. That's the first thing I do when I get back off the road. That's why a lot of times I hate leaving. The thing that I miss is my record collection and just sitting there and being able to pop open a bottle of wine and just listen to things.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you, Jeremy. Tell the people where they can find you.
I will be at Smoke with the same band on Our Community Won't Be Erased with Oren Evans, with Busta Williams, and with Lenny White, May 6th through the 10th. So please come on down and see us. It's going to be a great
So, and of course, we'll take the act over to Europe in July. But as far as stateside is concerned, we'll be at Smoke. And I'm eagerly anticipating that. And then on the 17th, I'll be at the Exit Zero Festival with my regular quintet, with the group that I recorded on Woven, which was my previous record, with Jalen Baker and Misha Mendelenko and Leighton Harrell and Jared Spears. And we're going to do the festival on the 17th of May, so I'm also looking forward to that. And getting back to, you know, my music, you know, but still having Miles and Train in my heart.
Yes, indeed. 100 years of those guys and some wonderful decades of you two and many more to you. And so thank you so much.
Milestones, celebrating the culture in partnership with WBGO Podcasts, produced and hosted by Angelica Beener. Theme music by Riley Glasper. Listen to Milestones wherever you get your favorite podcasts. For more from WBGO's entire podcast lineup, visit wbgo.org/podcasts.